And we begin with a profile of a man who symbolizes India now, Prime Minister Narendra Modi. In 2014, Narendra Modi became the Prime Minister of India, making him one of the most powerful men on the international stage. The first Indian PM with an absolute majority who doesn't owe allegiance to the Nehru Gandhi dynasty, the first from a lower caste family to lead the nation, although I must say in parentheses that on a previous LNL trip to India, I did spend a delightful day with the Dalit president in Delhi, and the first PM to have been born after India gained its independence. He's also one of the country's most contentious leaders, of course. He's been dubbed an extremist, a threat to democracy by critics, venerated as a mould breaker, a pragmatist, the strongman India needs by others. In many ways, he reflects the force of change, economic, social and religious, sweeping contemporary India. Now, to consider the context that shaped Modi, let us talk to one of India's most prominent journalists and observers. Pramit Pal Chowdhury is the foreign editor of the Hindustan Times, and I'd like to thank that paper for spreading the news of our visa dramas so effectively to its 1 million readers. Can you imagine a newspaper with that circulation? Pramit is an expert on foreign policy and international security. Pramit, welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome. I'm glad to be here.
I want to get a picture of the electorate just before Modi came to power. What was the state of the nation?
Well, it was actually quite dire in the sense that the second term of Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, the leader of the Congress coalition that had been in power for 10 years, the government was effectively falling apart. It had been racked by a number of major corruption scandals that had resulted in some ministers going to jail. But I think particularly damaging was a period of food inflation. Basic food commodities in India in the last 3 or 4 years of his term had seen prices rise by as much as 13 to 14% a year. And for a large portion of India's poor, the sight of a government that seemed to be having a lot of its ministers being arrested for taking huge amounts of money, combined with the fact that they saw their own pocketbooks shrinking, was really a reason for serious electoral anger. Electoral anger, which eventually manifested itself in the election of Modi.
India was about to get a junk rating on its economy, wasn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, if the Congress Party had come back to power, from my private conversations, a number of credit rating agencies were ready to declare India for the first time in its history really a junk rating nation, and there was an expectation of a huge amount of capital flight from the country.
But Pramit, didn't you get through the GFC pretty well?
Sorry, the GFC?
Yes, the global financial crisis.
Well, actually, yes, in India did. But keep in mind, the GFC in India actually worked in a different manner, in the sense that it actually reduced inflation and gave the government a little extra lifespan economically. But India's economy was effectively functioning separately from the rest of the world at that point. So what was really the problem was the combination of this inflation. India was an outrider internationally on that front, that we had inflation when the rest of the world was actually not having that problem. But the corruption scandals really ate into the legitimacy of the previous government, and it had really nothing to do with the GFC.
And yet I do recall talk of India, rushing to become the new China. Is that still the view?
Well, when you say about the new China, it depends on what you say. If you're saying that India can overtake China in economic growth rates, that's actually not too hard, partly because China has reduced its growth rate deliberately to about 6 or 7. China is now comfortable with a 6 or 7% growth rate. And so far, in most quarters under Prime Minister Modi, India has actually been the fastest growing major economy in the world. It lost it briefly in the so-called demonetization problem last year. But overall, that's actually an easy target. The real issue for India is, can we grow at 8, 9, maybe even 10%. And that's at the heart of many of the major economic reforms that Modi has been playing around with.
Some observers have compared the forces which brought Modi to power to those which triggered the Arab Spring, a younger generation, a sort of collective epiphany, an impatience with the rate of change. An exaggeration?
Yes, because the Arab Spring was an attempt to overthrow the entire structure of the political system in the Arab world. Modi is very much part of the Indian establishment. He is a chief minister who ruled the state of Gujarat for 3 terms. He's been a member of the BJP, one of the 2 main national parties for decades. The difference is that he's not part of the Delhi system. He never served in Delhi until he was a prime minister. But he comes from a political system. If you want to say he's an anti-establishment establishment, he overthrew the ruling structure of his own party to come to power. But he's not a revolutionary. He's very clear that he's within the framework of the Indian constitution and the India's present polity.
When introducing you, I made the point that he's the first man from a lower caste family to lead the nation. We're going to be talking about class. Just place him in the correct context.
Yeah, as a non-member of Delhi's establishment, he doesn't have the credentials that, let's say, the Gandhi Nehru family do. And he's not really low caste. He is actually a lower middle class caste, what we sometimes call in India OBCs, other backward castes. And so he's a sort of just somewhere in between being a recognized upper caste and a lower caste. But he comes from a caste that is poor. They're the Parsis, a caste of oil sellers and people who sell oil seed. They are traditionally quite poor and low. And so he comes from out of a very different background from most Indian politicians, only a handful, maybe Prime Minister Devagara, whose short-lived 6-month rule, come from a similar background. But he represents a very new India that's, should we say, coming to dominate the political spectrum. They're coming out of the small towns. They're people who are coming out of the villages and urbanized, living in urban situations for the first time in their lives. You can see a lot of them, but this is about 400 or 500 million people who are moving into this new era. And they are in many ways taking over, as you would expect in a democracy, taking over the Indian political system bit by bit. And Modi is the first example at the highest level, at the central government level, of them coming in. They've already come in and taken over a lot of state governments. We've had a lot of regional parties like the Bahujan Samajwad Party, which already represented this shift. But he's the first one to make it all the way to the prime minister.
You talk about this aspirational class. They're removed from the elites who make up the top quintile, and they identify with Modi rather than the leaders of Congress. Have the Congress lost them forever?
It's going to be a difficult battle. The Congress coalition used to incorporate the lower castes, the minorities that were in this case largely be Muslims, and the upper caste. And they kept a lot of the so-called backward caste, other backward castes in the middle, out of their political system. They lost the lower caste, the so-called Dalits, who formed their own party. And a lot of the higher caste then moved to the BJP over the years. Modi has now made a coalition, in effect, of upper castes, middle castes, and is now trying to win the lower castes into it. If he brings that in, then he's got a solid coalition that is something like 60% of the population and will be almost undefeatable. But Indian voters are very fickle. The average anti-incumbency sentiment in Indian election is about 40%. In other words, 40% of our members of parliament lose their seats every election. That's a pretty savage vote. So Modi is very popular. However, he has not yet, I would argue, translated that into popularity for his party. Most polls indicate that Modi is about twice as popular as his party is with the Indian public. So that would seem to indicate that after Modi, it's not necessarily clear that his party, the BJP, would necessarily continue to expect the same electoral turnout that he's getting.
Would it be stretching the argument enormously to say that there are some parallels between his sales pitch, you know, feeling new pride in India, and the Trumpian campaign?
I would argue Trump's argument was to appeal to a originally dominant group, the white working class of America, and say it's not over yet. I can still bring you back. In Modi's case, it's slightly different. He's talking to a group of people who are not empowered and saying that, no, you're the new India, and I'm going to create a new India for you in which you will be empowered. I think that's a crucial difference. And Trump, as we mentioned earlier, Trump, unlike Modi, Trump is completely outside of the political system in America. He's never held a political office. He's had nothing to do with American politics before. Modi is very much still within the framework of the Indian establishment and political structure, even though he sells himself as being slightly different.
Now, BJP, of course, have been in government before, but not with a majority.
Correct. In fact, and as you've mentioned, we've never had a single party absolute majority since 1984, when Rajiv Gandhi came to power. And many of us had assumed that we would never see it in our lifetime, given the nature of fragmentation in the Indian political system. I would be surprised, frankly. Modi has to go in the next election by April next 2019, whether he'll be able to retain the absolute majority, but I suspect it's coalition.
Forgive an ignorant question, although most of my questions are ignorant. Is it compulsory voting in India? Are you there?
Yes, hello.
Do you have compulsory voting in India as we do here?
No, we don't. It's completely voluntary, but turnout is very high, normally in the 60% range. But what has always been interesting about Indian democracy is that turnout in India is inversely proportional to your income. The poorer you are in India, the more likely you are to vote. And as a consequence, turnout at the lowest quintile of the population is often as high as 75 or 80%. The poor Indians take democracy very seriously. And that's been one of our biggest sources of strength, because it guarantees the legitimacy of the political system, even when it doesn't always succeed in delivering the goods.
My guest is Pramit Pal Chowdhury, foreign editor of the Hindustan Times, a paper which has a long history of being aligned with Congress. So I guess you were opposed editorially to a Modi victory.
No, actually. We stayed neutral on that position. The editorial line of the newspaper, the owners of the paper, as you mentioned, in fact, our present owner was a former Congress MP herself for a while, but she's never laid down a line on where we should stand. And we don't, as a policy in the paper, endorse specific candidates. What we do, however, is argue whether or not certain policies of the previous government were bad or good. And we were relatively critical of the Manmohan Singh government, as was most of the media by the end of it, since it had become so completely dysfunctional.
You mentioned that he has a lot of political experience, unlike Trump. Chief Minister of Gujarat for many years. What sort of a record did he have there? One thinks, of course, of the infamous riots.
Yes, and 2002 riots, which are unfortunately what he's probably best known for outside of Gujarat. His argument, or his supporters argue, that the riots took place roughly 3 months, I believe, just after he'd come to power. And so he had not... should we say, come to understand how exactly he should control the levers of power within the state. And they argue, and there I would tend to agree, that he did not instigate the riots. The riots happened on their own and were instigated by a further right-wing group, a more extreme right-wing group called the VHP, of whom he was actually not aligned with. But he did make a complete hash of stopping the riots, and some of his critics argue that, in fact, he decided it was better to just sit back and let them burn themselves out. But on the other hand, what he is famous for is a so-called Gujarat model in India, where he was able to combine a degree of huge investment in infrastructure, a remarkably clean government in terms of corruption, ability to attract investment resulted in Gujarat having remarkably high rates of economic growth during that 12-year period, which eventually by the end of it, he was so successful that 15% of the Muslim Muslims in Gujarat voted for him. Just on the economic argument.
That singular and simple fact will astonish most listeners.
I think it astonished most people in India too, but a lot of Muslims accept it. There's a famous incident where Modi met Muslim leaders in a town and asked, they complained, they said, "We don't expect us to vote for you." And he told them, he says, "Why do you think Muslims and Hindus fight?" And after some deep thought, the Muslim leader said, "Because we're all poor and we essentially fight over the scraps." He said, "Exactly. So one day, if I can make all of us wealthy, this will all stop. That's why you should vote for me." And in that town, the BJP, in a town that was a Muslim majority town, the BJP went on to sweep 3/4 of the seats in the municipal elections. But it's a message that Modi continues to say, especially in private, and I've met fellow Muslim friends who've met him. And they say, he'll tell them, he says, "Look, this is all a consequence of poverty. When I bring that to an end, then all of this will stop as well."
And of course, in neighbouring states where nothing worked, Gujarat acquired this mythical status. Well, not mythical, a deserved status. Now, Modi made a lot of promises, but as you say, development was and remains the biggest promise.
That's correct. And I think at the heart of what his strategy, I would argue, is that the Congress, especially in the past few years, have sort of given up on the idea that we can actually grow the pie in India fast enough. So the Congress's view was we move to what they called a rights-based economic policy of basically welfare programs, large-scale welfare programs, empowering property rights for very poor people and so on, and then basically letting it off at that. Modi's argument has been different. His view has been that, no, you need to carry out major structural reforms in the economy so that India's growth rate can continue to rise until you reach, you know, the 8, 9, 10% growth rate. At this point, the pie becomes big enough that India can afford to do both welfare as well as investment, as well as supporting its business community and its corporations to grow altogether. So his focus has been largely on the structural reform side, even though it has traditionally been viewed by the Indian political class that structural reforms are so painful that they essentially cost you votes and are probably best avoided when you can.
Pramat, up the road in China, the one-child policy was almost too effective and it's now been eradicated. But there's a very, very, very slow population growth in China. In fact, they're now looking down the barrel of a dramatically aging population. What's the situation in India?
To check off, but if I remember correctly, our growth rate is not high. It's, I think, about 2.3-2.4%. But the real shift in India has been regional. It's best to look at India as a group of regions and see how each is developing. South India is now effectively negative growth rates. It's below replacement level. Western India is now heading in the same direction as southern India. Eastern India is probably now just at replacement or just a little above replacement level. The worst part, and this continues to be the area India has struggles with, is northern India, which unfortunately is also our most populous. And there the growth rate is almost 3. That continues to be the backward, most backward, most populous, and to some degree also the one that where a lot of the worst religious and sectarian issues continue to bedevil the country. North India, the growth rate continues to be high, and we have not yet been able to actually address that.
You've dealt with Modi personally. I'm fascinated that he's celibate, a vegetarian, hardly sleeps. Is his personality a major part of his appeal?
Yes. One of the reasons why a lot of common Indians believe that he says that I am free of corruption is most Indians say, well, he has no family. And he's basically a monk. So what is he going to do with the money if he was to pocket money? What would he do with it? The number one reason most Indians, if when they're caught for corruption, will tell you they're doing it is because of their, for their family. And in India, that means often a very extended family. And the fact that he doesn't have any, most Indians take it for granted that he's being honest when he says I don't take money. And this entire monkishness about him, and he's a failed monk. He tried for 4 years to join a monastery, the Ramakrishna Mission, and failed because he was considered, I gather, too hyperactive.
But Pramod, I don't like to interrupt, but sure. I can think of another couple of world leaders who had a period as monks. One of them was Stalin, and the other was a certain gentleman in Cambodia. So it's not always a good thing.
Well, I would say that they turned away from their religions. I don't think Stalin was God-fearing. Modi remains very much a religious person, very much dedicated to Hinduism. And as you know, he practices yoga. I believe he's now added Pilates. And the mission, the Ramakrishna Mission monastery that he tried to join, he remains very close to them. In fact, in private, he will tell you that the only institution that he retains complete fealty to is the Ramakrishna Mission. It comes to my hometown. It's based in my hometown of Calcutta. And every time he goes there, he visits the monastery and speaks to the elders there, which is interesting because it's a very liberal institution. It's an extremely liberal Hindu order. So one wonders, therefore, because it's not in sync with his actual party, the rest of his party.
Who are his friends internationally?
I would say that the person, when he came to power, it was very clear that two people he had a very close relationship with was Shinzo Abe of Japan. And I think it's still true to say that if you look at Shinzo Abe's Twitter account, there are only three people he follows: his wife, his favorite poet, and Narendra Modi. And he and Modi and he get along really like a house on fire. He's close to Bibi Netanyahu of Israel. Netanyahu recently visited for 1 week. He's a great admirer, as many people in the BJP are, of Israel. But he developed, to our surprise, a strong relationship with Barack Obama. And he used to call him my friend Barack. And Obama recently, in fact, came to India as a guest of my newspaper. And Modi and me immediately had a meal together. He's also developing a decent relationship with Donald Trump. Again, I have to admit, a bit to our surprise. Trump is not a monk by most standards. But he was also very close to, he liked Abbott. He liked Tony Abbott, who I know is not very popular in Australia. But Abbott's sort of Jesuit background, I think, appealed to Modi. He likes that type of a sort of straight-laced individual.
And as you've often pointed out, this is a guy who not only works incredibly hard, but seems to have no life outside of politics.
Exactly. Yeah. Friends of mine who worked with him in the Prime Minister's office said, you give up on your family because he does not actually do anything other than work.
This is LNL on RN, and we are defying the odds and still talking to India despite recent political events, which I must say, our visas were not forthcoming despite very, very high level diplomatic efforts. Modi asks voters to judge his record, or has asked them to judge his record, after the first 5 years. Well, we're coming up for 5 years this year. Give us your report card.
I think that there are a couple of things that he has done. Modi has understood that for poor people in India, it's not just a question of giving them money. It's a question of their dignity. And if you look at the opinion polls, it's actually interesting. The program that is most popular, especially with the poor and especially with women, has been his Swachh Bharat campaign, which means Clean India campaign. It's more of a social movement than a government policy, but it's about building toilets. It's about cleaning up a lot of the muck that lies around in the country, sewage, pollution. And it's not been very successful. It's a very difficult task, except on the toilet building part. I don't think there's much to be has been accomplished. But the fact that he's focused on this so much has gone down well, as he's basically made the argument, poor people live in filth, not because they like it, it's because they have no choice, and we need to do something about it. So this has been wildly popular, by far the number one issue with poor in India. The second part, which is where you go into the economic reform side, he's made the argument that, which all the Indian economists have made for decades, is that 50% of India's GDP comes from the informal sector, the so-called black economy. This is not taxed. It's low productivity. It's slave wages, unregulated. And a lot of it has launched four different programs, demonetization, a new nationwide sales tax similar to the Australian GST, a real estate regulatory authority, and a bankruptcy insolvency code, which collectively basically are designed to destroy or eradicate a large portion of this informal sector and force it into the formal sector. This has been highly disruptive to the economy, and it's affected poor people very badly. But what his biggest accomplishment, and it's been astonishing for journalists, is that he's gone out to the poor. And he said, I know you're hurting because of this, because a lot of you get your jobs and your income from the black economy. But understand that one of the reasons you're poor is because you're forced to work in this. And second, it is the source of corruption in this country. The black money of this economy feeds the corruption that keeps you poor. So therefore, bear with me and let me see what and once I get this solved, you are going to do much better. And it's amazing. When you look at the polling evidence, it continues to be barely about 10 or 15% of the electorate look upon these reforms, which have been highly criticized by middle-class intellectuals. But only 10 or 15% of the population think they were bad. Those have been really two of the most remarkable things about his ability as a communicator to sit down and say, I have a vision, and I'm going to do this, and some of you are going to get hurt. Bear with me, because you're going to do better out of this in the long run.
From your writings, I know that you argue that nationalism has a stronger hold amongst those climbing the ladder because the pace of change is so fast.
Completely true. I think you're seeing, as if you're a village person in India, you leave a very rigid caste-based structure, or one where everybody pretty much knows his place, including women and other people, and you know your social relationships. Suddenly you're propelled into a large city, and Indian cities are very large. And where, for example, you may be an upper caste person in the village, in the city nobody cares what you are, where women will treat you in a way that you're not used to. And so your entire value structure effectively is either under threat or basically disintegrates. A lot of that population now begin as they earn income, but have a value structure that is somewhat nebulous, taken up to nationalism. It's not exactly a phenomenon that existed in 19th century Europe, even 18th century Europe, saw it in America at the turn of the century. Presumably Australia went through a similar phase. So you'll see this burst of nationalism that took place. The question is, can that nationalism be controlled and eventually used constructively rather than destructively, both in terms of your external policies, but also in terms of developing a sense of national identity that is much more inclusive as inclusive as you would like expect a liberal democracy to be.
We've only got a few seconds left, but so my last question to you is, the obvious criticism within India and certainly around the world is that Modi turns a blind eye to the extremists in his party.
Completely true. I think Modi's game has been, he does not support them publicly. He has never used the expression Hindutva, a reference to this religious nationalist philosophy, in any of his speeches. What he does is he leaves it to the state government. When I've asked his aides, I said, are you sure this is a good idea? Because the polls indicate that this is not a popular policy. And their argument is straightforward. The first BJP government was a very liberal government, and it lost the elections, despite having a very popular prime minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee. Why did it lose? Because their analysis is that 8 to 9 percentage points of the electorate sat home and refused to vote for the BJP. And who were they? They were the BJP's own core base. So they said, we now believe we have to give them something. Otherwise, we lose our base. And it's not necessarily clear to us that the liberal middle class will vote for us.
Pramath, we've got to wind it up. Thank you once again for your terrific contribution to our program. Pramath Palchaudhuri, Foreign Editor of the Hindustan Times.